Something useful that Merrick Garland could do for the future of American democracy and the stability of the constitutional order is resign.
God, I love this take so much.
You know, because that would generate...
I've never been so attracted to you, Matt. Hey everyone, you're listening to a free preview of the Politics Podcast. In this episode, we're going to reflect briefly on last week's State of the Union address, but we really wanted to use the speech as a segue into discussing Donald Trump's subsequent and pretty abrupt 180 on his longstanding promise not to cut Medicare or Social Security. So what precipitated that, and what can Democrats do about it other than use it in campaign ads? So we hope you enjoy the conversation, and if you like what you're hearing and want to listen to the whole episode, you can upgrade your subscription to paid at politics.fm. Hey everyone, welcome to the Politics Podcast. I'm Brian Beutler.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
So this week we'll do a quick drive-by of President Biden's State of the Union address, but we really want to talk about what happened since. Biden once again used the State of the Union to browbeat Republicans for planning to cut Social Security and Medicare, and Republicans in the past had kind of feigned outrage as if this was not actually part of their plans. But this time, Donald Trump just kind of came out and said, yeah, we'll cut Social Security and Medicare, maybe. So that's going to be the crux of it. But we did want to acknowledge that there was a big political event at the State of the Union address and sort of put it into the political context of the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Joe Biden went to Congress. He delivered a very loud speech. And I thought it was... Honestly, like, it was weird. This seems to have set a lot of people's concerns to rest about Biden's age, et cetera, because he went up. He, like, gave a partisan stemwinder of a speech. Those of us who don't have the memory of a sea slug may recall that this actually happened a year ago at the last State of the Union address, in which both times the obstreperousness of the some of the backbench Republicans interrupting his speech and stuff actually gave him occasion to go off script. And, like, you know, as with any of these things... there can be criticisms of the speech, et cetera. But like Ezra Klein did a column about how, oh, maybe I was wrong about Biden's age. Biden took what's clearly a lightly reworked version of the State of the Union speech, has been using it on the stump for the past couple days. It's a good speech. Like, it's all good. I think we did see in the back and forth where, like, Biden used the word illegals. And then he got some criticism of that from, you know, progressive groups. And then he was like, ah, maybe I shouldn't have said that. You know, I don't think it's a huge deal either way. But to me, that underscores what is, like, the genuine tension around Biden speaking off the cuff, which is that he speaks like an 80-year-old man. Not in the sense of, like, he's too old to speak, but, like, as any of us know in our
he's old
lives,
fashioned.
Like, yeah, like, old people, I mean, I remember one time talking to, like, my grandma, and she's going off about, like, the blacks are like this, the Jews are like that, and, like, she's Jewish. You know, it's just like an old person way of talking, and, like, me and my cousins are like, ugh. And, you know, when Trump says insane stuff, he gets backed up by all his people. Which is, I think, what we're going to come to here, because Trump has a bunch of new takes after meeting with donors at the Club for Growth.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think that to me, the State of the Union address reprised the history of 2020, where Republicans ran the same basic play against Joe Biden, that he's sleepy, that he's running his campaign from his basement, that he can't string sentences together. And then the big proof point that was wrong was the debates with Donald Trump. And I thought that the lesson that they learned from that was that there is a risk in setting the bar so low against your opponent. But apparently the lesson didn't take, because they just ran the same play. And now it's the State of the Union address that provided Biden the, like, very low bar to tiptoe over or whatever. So I think that was, like, the main political takeaway that most people correctly left with. And then it was set against, there was a very bad official response. And I mean, they're almost all very bad, but this one was particularly cringe inducing. And then as a couple of days went by, the journalist Jonathan Katz discovered that there was a big lie embedded in
One of her central anecdotes.
Yeah. She was basically trying to blame Joe Biden for the trafficking of this minor who had actually been trafficked in the George W. Bush administration, and it had nothing to do with the U.S. border. All of the horrible things that happened to this woman happened in Mexico. So that was the lie. And so you had this really great, I think, for Democrats, juxtaposition where Biden's speech got a lot of praise from the kinds of journalists who do theater criticism, and the Republican response got a lot of criticism, and then it kind of snowballed into this, like, why did you lie? Pylon of Katie Britt, the Alabama senator who did it. So those are the, to me, the two big things. And then you're right. There were like these smaller tier things that kind of cropped up, like the tension between Joe Biden delivering a solid speech in which he uses like a politically disfavored or non-politically correct term, and like a small blow up. But to me, like the main point about that is that, like, well, I guess it's just to agree with you. Like,
yeah, I mean, I just think the lesson is that, like, you're better running the campaign than, like, not running the campaign, right? Like, he's the nominee. And, like, when he gives a speech that, like, reflects his ideas and his talking points and he goes after the opposition, and, like, it's just better on net.
Yeah. I wasn't certain watching it whether this was, like, his articulation or like a reflection of how he speaks in private, or whether he was just kind of like echoing, because he was in this like shouting match essentially with Marjorie Taylor Greene, and she obviously uses the term illegal all the time as a noun. And so I kind of thought he's just reflecting back to her what she's screaming at him. And I had kind of hoped that it would die, because it's just not that big a deal in the grand scheme of things. But like the intra-left pressure did get to him. He did kind of atone for it in an interview with I forget who now. And now it gave the story new life and kind of undercut the political value of the moment, because now Republicans are off to the races saying Joe Biden is apologizing to these migrant murderers or whatever.
Yeah, but you know, all things considered, like something that I have just seen going to the week before the speech and continuing after the speech that I think is noteworthy, which is that, you know, Democrats embrace this bipartisan border security bill that, you know, I know as the negotiations were happening, people had very mixed feelings about. And then Trump, you know, killed it, pulled the plug on it for his own kind of political advantage. But you can just see, like, in their faces when they appear on television that, like, Democrats of all stripes actually, like, enjoy being out of their political hole on this and, like, having a good answer that they can give. And everybody enjoyed Biden's speech, you know, because, like, it was good. And he stuck very much to sort of political safe ground.
Well, and he stuck it to the Republicans, and that feels good.
Right. And just something that I think about politics, and because we're going to get back to Trump and Social Security, is I think that everyone underestimates ex ante how much they enjoy winning when they win, right? Like, I think that if you had gone to, like, conservative movement high command in spring of 2012 and been like, maybe you guys should just, like, shake the Etch-a-Sketch and just, like, totally abandon these politically controversial plans to cut entitlement spending, because that'll help you beat Barack Obama, that, like, Republicans would have been like, oh no, man, like, we can't do that, right? Like, what would the victory even be worth? Like, we can't sell out all of our convictions and all of our ideas. But, like, when Donald Trump won in 2016, whatever you think of how he won, et cetera, like, Republicans started feeling way better about Trump.
Like, oh, people, man, they were beaming.
Right. Because, like, I just think it's, like, it's important to remember that. And, like, left-wing progressives who had very mixed feelings about Joe Biden all throughout the 2020 cycle were, like, really happy when he won, you know? And just, like, people like winning. People like winning more than they think they're going to like winning. I actually think, like, we're all hate our enemies maybe a little bit more than we would like to admit, and are, like, slightly less attached to the specific details of our principles than we would like to think. And there's just, like, something, good about sort of playing to win, but because I want to talk about Trump, there are people involved in politics in a highly transactional way. And notably, this guy, Jeff Yass, who's a rich investor guy, he has been involved in conservative politics for many years as a donor, I'm sure has like incredibly sincere beliefs in all kinds of conservative causes, but he's also a major investor in TikTok. And so one of the things he's been doing over the past few years is trying to get all of his Republican Party colleagues to like stop bashing TikTok and stop trying to make the Chinese government sell it, because, you know, he's a guy who's got billions of dollars on the line in this transaction. And an interesting thing about Trump is, you know, we were been talking for weeks about his financial difficulties. He's trying much harder this time around to get people with money to give the money to him. And that has led him to totally turn it around on this TikTok question, which used to be a signature issue of his. And then he very enigmatically, right as Congress had a 50-0 vote in committee, is like, oh no, guys, like TikTok's great. Coming 6 days after he has a meeting with this Republican donor who used to be, I wouldn't say like a never Trump, but like a, you know, like a, he was like a Ron DeSantis booster. And it's really, you know, I don't think this TikTok issue is like the most important topic of our times, although I do think it matters, but it's like telling of Trump's approach to everything. Like so many people on the right, I think have like convince themselves that they're so annoyed by liberals that like actually Donald Trump is great and he's this like amazing champion of their causes, but he still is and always will be this kind of, you know, high-end con man who sells people out for personal gain on a dime. And like that's what he just did.
You don't think that there's some progressive billionaire who's giving Joe Biden large cash infusions to switch his views on immigration?
I mean, you know, like there are many billionaires out there, but no, you know, it's like, it's rare in politics. I think rarer than people think for politicians to just like flip on a dime for campaign contributions, because the reality is that like, if you want to go to bat for coal companies, there's coal companies who'll give you money. And if you want to go to bat for environmental causes, there's environmentalist donors who'll give you money. You know, like there's lots of like things out there. There's lots of people. And, you know, it's a bad look to be unprincipled. And also most people get into politics like because they care about stuff. But like Trump really doesn't care about things. And sometimes like when Trump just like unilaterally drops the Bud Light culture war in exchange for a fundraiser, you're kind of like, oh, this is like maybe the appealing side of Trump, is he's like less of an ideologue than a lot of the other people on the right. But, you know, like it's scary. He's a genuinely unprincipled demagogue, which is both what makes him dangerous in terms of his willingness to abuse the powers of office, but also like not a horse you should back. Like people have this fantasy that like, well, he's going to abuse power like to own the libs. But like, that's not what he's doing on TikTok. Like, he's just helping out a donor. He's helping out the Chinese government.
Yeah, and Elon Musk maybe too, who endorsed this because Mark Zuckerberg clowned him over the fist fight that they were supposed to have. Let's do two quick things, like political things about State of the Union, and then like,
yeah,
since we've already kind of spoiled the Easter egg a little bit. The first one is that it was like an important counterpoint to the discourse that had ensued since the Robert Hur special counsel report came out, where this Republican prosecutor described Biden as this like kind but elderly and forgetful person, as like one of the reasons why even if he weren't president, he wouldn't face prosecution for having held on to some classified material in his archives when he left the Obama White House. We were recording this Tuesday morning, and have sort of just learned that in addition to having kind of disproved Robert Herr's characterization in real time before an audience of tens of millions of people, Robert Herr was more or less just lying in his report, because the transcript of his interview with Biden came out, and it turns out like he didn't really forget when his son Beau died the way Herr suggested. And he, to the extent that he forgot, like, for instance, who in the Obama administration he was allied with on Afghanistan, it was just like a slip of the name, because later in the interview, he said that the right one. So it's not like he was having fog of memory and in interposing people. He just, in the same way that I might like refer to you as Ezra, if you and Ezra and I were in a room together, he just like switched the names up in his head. So basically, like on the basis of like really thin evidence, Herr maligned Biden. And now there's this second comeuppance happening where not only did the State of the Union prove that Biden's not the enfeebled person Herr depicted him as, but also that Herr really was like a just a slimy partisan operator here. And now there's a lot of evidence for it, because this is coming out. He's going to testify to Congress at like basically as we're recording this, with the help of a couple Republican campaign operatives. So I think that my hope is that this is not one of these sorts of things where like the false version of the story gets all the views and then the corrected version gets none. Like, I think that the backlash to Herr's deceit here might have some legs.
I mean, one hopes. I'm always like skeptical, because like I hope it does. You know what I mean? I don't want to like prejudge this cynically, but like the whole thing was insane to me. How like we have all familiar with the general idea of prosecuting crimes, and like you just don't get to on the way out the door be like, well, the guy's innocent, but like here's some political oppo research. Mm-hmm. And like this is 2024. It's not like the full transcripts were like arriving via stagecoach from the Rockies. You know what I mean? It's like, if you're saying this, like, why are you saying this? Like, where is the evidence? Like, it's literally an evidence gathering process. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I hope that media people who wrote stories taking her statements at face value are now thinking to themselves, wow, I feel a little bit embarrassed and burned by this guy, and I'm going to take a more skeptical view of it. Fear is that what they're saying to themselves is, well, we got a lot of traffic to the stories that we did before, so that's our job. Like, our stories were accurate in the sense that, like, Robert Herr did say the things that our stories said they said, and they also obtained a lot of web traffic. So, like,
but I think that these aren't mutually exclusive.
No, they're not. Like, they're not. But I just mean, you know, there's just always a question of like your constant re-updating, right? Because like he's going to go do this testimony. And like, again, the testimony is going to be, it's going to be at a House Republican committee hearing, structured as it was. And I'm sure that like the things that Herr says at the hearing will be politically damaging to Joe Biden. And then you have the question as a journalist, like, do we write those up straight? Do we put it on the front page? Do we treat this hearing as like live cable news, you know, or do we like put this to the side as a partisan sideshow? Like, I think clearly the moral of today is that anything that Robert Herr does in the future belongs in the partisan sideshow waste bin, not in the this is a serious news event, we need to see what happens bucket. But I'm not sure, you know, where we're gonna go with that.
You know, by the time this episode runs, we'll know the answer. I have a fair amount of faith in House Democratic committee questioners, and I think that House Republican committee questioners are so up their asses that they often screw up. But I mean, the dynamic I was actually getting at was more like the one where, you know, these more or less same reporters kind of clown themselves by missing this big lie that Katie Brit embedded into her State of the Union response. But when they were like found to have missed it by an independent journalist, it's not like they were like, well, sucks because that guy found it, so we're going to pretend it didn't happen. They went out and they like turned it into a next day story because you can get a lot of clicks that way too, right? And so if they decide they want to make a controversy out of the fact that Robert Hur misled them the same way Katie Britt did, they can do that, right? Like they can demand answers from him directly because he's not at DOJ anymore, from the Republican operatives who helped him plan his prepare for his hearing. And they can go to the Republican committee chairs who want to exploit this and say, you know, you base this all on a lie, and we'll see.
I hope so. Yeah. Here's what I'll say. This is, I think, a boiler-like take that I'm going to offer, but like something useful that Merrick Garland could do for the future of American democracy and the stability of the constitutional order is resign, is to say that he is outraged by what Robert Hur did, that this is one of the most egregious abuses of power that he has ever seen by any prosecutor, that it is a complete and total disgrace to the Justice Department, to the American legal system, and that he personally feels humiliated by this, that his own egregious judgment here is awful, and that he has jeopardized the rule of law, the integrity of the legal system, and like, I am quitting. You know, like I fucked this up because Robert Hur is like one of the worst people to ever come around.
God, I love this take so much.
You know, because that would generate,
I've never been so attracted to you, Matt.
That would generate a lot of interest in this question, right? And like, because it would be unusual at times, you know, for somebody to resign like that, to fall on their sword. And then people would have like second order accounts, and Joe Biden could be magnanimous and say, Merrick Garland has done so many great things for America over the years, you know, prosecuting terrorism, et cetera. It's so horrible that this guy, Robert Hur, just like fucked everything up. And you know, and like, Lisa Monaco can be acting attorney general. Like it's fine, you know, or you can have a confirmation battle if you want. But like, we've had a lot of different instances across time and space of various political actors acting like they are bigger than the game, you know, in ways that have been damaging. And Garland, who I have like a lot of various problems with, he doesn't seem like a, you know, he's not like an egomaniacal politician.
He's not a smoothie like Jim Comey, but I do think he is a lot of moral vanity, is I think.
Right. But I mean, this is like why I'm pitching it. Like he should take that moral vanity and deploy it to good use.
Inward, yeah.
Because like he's not a glad-handing Paul who like just like loves being at the center of public attention and seems like he's thrilled to have this job. Right? Like he cares about his reputation, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And like admitting that he fucked this up will burnish his reputation better than anything else he could possibly do, like shuffling off into the sideline, and will really dramatize this and will force the issue of like, how do we understand what Hur did here? Like, because it should be understood that like, this is an egregious, and look, anybody, if they had just put this transcript out, right? Something that we are all entitled to do as human beings is look through a long transcript, pull exchanges slightly out of context, and characterize them in ways that, you know, we think advance our political agenda. If Joe Biden talked for a long time in these things, there are instances where he was like, was that this year or that year? And like, you can just screenshot that and be like, he forgot what year this happened. And like, did he actually, like anyone who understands how human conversations work? Like, no, you listen to this live podcast or any podcast. People misspeak, people backtrack around themselves, people say things that aren't completely grammatical. Like, it's totally fine. But Hur didn't put the evidence out there and let bad faith conservative media personalities selectively edit it. He did the selective editing himself. And like, that's just a total dereliction of duty, and it deserves to be strongly characterized as such. And really, Garland is in a unique position to do that.
I love this take, man. Merrick Garland. I mean, I think I probably called on Merrick Garland to resign 7 or 8
You're
times.
Always calling on him to resign.
but I like, it's always kind of been a reach. Like, he should resign because it would be the better thing, or he's wrong for the moment. Never like his vain desire to be viewed as this like Atticus Finch style hero has really like put the whole country at risk. And like the only way for him to reclaim like any sense of like dignity or integrity, like when you look at his career work as a whole, would be to fall on his sword. We're going to clip this bit of the podcast and put it out there, and you know, maybe somebody can email it to him.
Sure.
Should we put the paywall here and then talk about Social Security, Medicare entirely behind it? Or
let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay.
You got to pay if you want those. There's no entitlements here, you know.
Yeah, no, and there's a really like fun corruption angle to the Social Security and Medicare U-turn that Trump did also. So you better upgrade your subscription if you want to hear that too.